Thank you. In our study tonight, if you would please open your Bibles to the book of Exodus, the 14th, 15th, and forward is where we're going to be going in our study tonight. We want to review just a little bit because there's an objective to our study, of course, and that is to find the fulfillment of the promises that God made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, those three promises, the land promise, the nation promise, and the seed promise. Of course, as we come to the Galatian letter, we looked at that some in our last study in the third chapter, we find emphasized the seed promise. When God spoke unto Abraham, he said unto thy seed, not seeds, Paul says, as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, singular, which is Christ, verse 16, Galatians chapter 3. Now, when God made the promise initially to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, we see the order of fulfillment be the nation promise, the land promise, and the seed promise, and that's how we're going to approach them in our study as we get to the fulfillment of those. In our last study, we noted in the 14th chapter of the book of Exodus, as they came across the Red Sea, that God dried up the Red Sea in verse 21 by a strong east wind. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, verse 22. We note in verse 23 that the Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass in the morning watch that Jehovah looked forth upon the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of cloud, and discomfited the host of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels, and they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for Jehovah fighteth for them against the Egyptians." God is bringing about the deliverance of his people, just as he has promised. Now, the question that I have on the board, where did they cross? No man knows for sure where that was. Now, I asked you to last time, if you would like, to go to a particular website, bible.ca, and do a little reading on the crossing of the Red Sea, if you would like to do that. There are a number of points of supposed crossings that men have thought to be where they came across through the years. And the one in our book is, though we have a question mark, surrounding it here at the bottom of the page, is perhaps the most traditional place of the crossings that we see in maps that are of any age. There are alternative crossing points, however. And the thing that makes that very difficult is to identify some of the encampments and the locations where those places are. Now, we've talked about how long ago we're talking about 3,500 years. And to identify a place where the children of Israel, though they be large in number, 2 to 3 million people, to identify where they spent a week or 2 weeks or a month could be very, very difficult. Some of the geographical points of interest that we see identified in the Scriptures certainly help us a little bit with that. This is the map that Steve Rudd has on his web page or website that might be helpful to you. I want you to see the traditional crossing comes down through the western side of Mount Sinai. The traditional crossing has the children of Israel crossing through the Gulf of Suez, the left-hand finger of the Red Sea. Others suppose, regardless of whether it is a northern or a southern crossing, some suppose that the crossing was on the Gulf of Aqaba, the right-hand finger of the Red Sea. And that's all interesting to me. And there are reasons for the identifying of these various places. I want to throw out just a little bit of that and not necessarily, I don't want to spend all the class time discussing the location of these places because it's so uncertain. And I realize the danger of even suggesting alternate views and saying, let's limit our discussion, because it's difficult to do that. But what I want you to do is to notice that the traditional crossing is up in the northern area of the Gulf of Suez, which would then bring them down. And, of course, this is the traditional sighting of Mount Sinai. Some of the maps that you will read and some of the history that you will read will put Mount Sinai over here. Now, strangely enough, this we have, and I thought was just standard procedure, the Sinai Peninsula. Well, it was called the Sinai Peninsula after scholars and archaeologists and so forth began to think that this mountain was Mount Sinai. Therefore, then, this would be the Sinai Peninsula. Others believe that there is a great deal more credible evidence of locating Mount Sinai over here in Arabia. In fact, in Galatians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul identifies Mount Sinai in Arabia as he talks about the bondwoman and her son and the free woman and her son, and you can read that and study that and let the evidence weigh as it will. But if you have Mount Sinai over here, then you move by virtue of that location almost everything over to the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba into the region of Arabia. And that repositions a lot of encampments. And there are reasons for that, but at any rate, what I want to do is, in our study this evening, is to follow the outline primarily that's given in our book, because that's what I suppose most of you have been studying from, and we will discuss the events that occur at the locations of these places as they are identified in our book. Now, according to our book, the author describes the Israelites crossing somewhere in the northern tip of the left arm of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez, because they crossed into the wilderness of Sinai. Now, that would all make good sense if indeed this is the wilderness of Sinai instead of this, the wilderness of Sinai, as Steve Rudd has it on his map. And so everything is repositioned, as we said, further east when you take that position. But one of the things that we do note is that they travel 3 days through the wilderness of Shur. Exodus chapter 15 describes that for us, beginning in verses 22 and 23. And they came then to a place called Marah. Now again, the location, the exact location of some of these places, I can't be sure of, and I'm not sure that you can either, but be that as it may, wherever this is located on the map, it tells us that the waters were bitter. Now, we talked about possibilities in our last study. Does that mean that it was undrinkable because of its taste? Does it mean it was undrinkable because it was brackish or because of the salinity of the water in this area? Was it undrinkable because it was poison? Or bitter? And there may be a number of reasons why it was bitter. But they complained. Now, the thing that I want to note just here is, look at what they've seen. We're talking about the children of Israel who have been down in Egypt as slaves and have been set free. Here are the children of Israel that have seen the plagues that God brought upon the people of Egypt. Here are the people of Israel who have seen the waters of the Red Sea part, whether it be on the Gulf of Suez or the Gulf of Aqaba. This is what they've seen. And they've seen Pharaoh and all his army in their hot pursuit ultimately destroyed according to what God had said, that you will see them no more after this day. It's all going to be over for Pharaoh and his army. And now here we have them complaining because the waters are bitter. Yes. No. That's correct. That's correct. That's right. This was just days ago that they saw this. Just days ago that they saw Pharaoh and all of his army destroyed. Now, another interesting note, John, you brought this up last time, and I don't know a whole lot more tonight than I did last week about your question. How long has it been since they came out of Egypt till they now stand at the Red Sea? I don't know the answer to that. Some have suggested that it was just a matter of like an overnight or something to that effect. Some have suggested that it was a little longer than that. Some have even suggested that before they crossed the Red Sea, those who take the position that it was the Gulf of Aqaba instead of the Gulf of Suez argue that Israel, and I'll go back to this map, that Israel has come down by land to here and then come up to Etham and then dropped down to here where it is believed they crossed and waited 8 days for Pharaoh to arrive. So there's a lot of questions that I don't know the answer to in terms of specific time. But you're right, Chris, regarding the history of these events. We're not talking about things that occurred in the long distant past, but things that have occurred within the last very few days. And Israel has been witness to these things. Yes?
Seems like, I guess we can have short memories today. It's good for us to remember, but keeping that in mind, when Pharaoh got mad at them once when they were in Egypt and said, now you've got to make brick but not straw for me. So they complained to Moses then, he really hurt us. Mm-hmm. Now we're trying to make bricks without straw. And I just kind of wonder if that carried over. I thought Moses was trying to hurt them.
Well, yeah, when they first saw Moses, when he came down, they didn't want Moses to be down there to do what he was proposing to be done. And even as they are led out by Moses and came to the edge of the Red Sea in Exodus 14, their attitude is, this is what we told you about while we were back there. And you can read that in verse 12. That the Egyptians, they're going to kill us. And wasn't there enough graves back there that you bring us out into this wilderness to be killed? So, yes, complaining just seems to be a part of their history and is going to be through this period of wilderness journey.
As far as the timeline, we know that maximum is 2.5 months. Starting chapter 16 at 2.5 months.
Right, right.
So it's still, I mean, from day one of leaving Egypt, well, they didn't leave Egypt on day one. They started the Passover on,
right,
on day one.
Right.
So, I mean, it's still a fairly short period of time.
Very short period of time. That's right. And it appears that all of these great things that God has done for them somehow have been lost in their thinking, as they forget that God has provided for them, and He has declared that He will. Now, if you do a Google Earth, this is a photograph, but if you do a Google Earth search and zoom in on some of these wilderness areas, you'll find land that has these deep gorges in it that is known as wilderness area, which certainly would make it difficult to provide for the needs of 2 to 3 million people in a barren wilderness like this. I seldom go out to Jawbone Canyon or Mojave or areas even around here that appear to be quite desolate without raising the question, what would you do with that many people in an area like this? If we're talking about a family or one or two people, you might be able to find provisions. But for that many people, what do you feed them? Where do they drink? I mean, one or two or a small number, you could find a spring perhaps, but when you've got this many people and flocks too, what do you do for food and water? And so that becomes a question evidently that they're thinking about. What do we do about this? Now, according to our book, this is the course that is taken across the Red Sea down to Marah, where the waters were bitter and God provides for them in verses 22 and 23. And then they travel down to Elam, where there are 12 natural springs, verse 27. And when they were come to Elam, where were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the waters. Now that would be real easy if we were to go the day after they were there and say, you know, this has got to be it, because look at all the footprints, and yes, here are 12 wells and here's 70 palm trees, but over a period of 3,500 years, I doubt those same palm trees are there. So making the location of these encampments very, very difficult. And you see, they were not here for an extremely long period of time to put down foundations and that sort of thing that would be easily recognizable. Now, it's very clear to us when we look at this map that though they are traveling very near the sea, that the water of the sea is not going to be drinkable. Why?
Saline.
Or it's salt water, and you can't drink salt water. Well, I guess you can, but you throw up. So it won't be very nourishing to you. And so these wells or springs, rather, were very important to them. And they continued to journey. And the text tells us that they came down to Elam. Here's our map that's consistent with the lesson book that you're reading from, Exodus chapter 15, verse 27. And then they proceed. But look, if you will, in chapter 16, Chris, this is your point, in verses 1 and 2, it says, "And they took their journey from Elam, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron in the wilderness, and the children of Israel said unto them, Would that we had died by the hand of Jehovah in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full, for ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." They're fussing and complaining again. And the thing I find very interesting in this text is they are remembering what provisions they had in Egypt. No doubt what provisions the Egyptians gave to them in Egypt, rather than to think of what God had done for them in bringing them up out of Egypt. Kim?
I don't know if we went over this last week, wilderness of Sin, is that the same as Sinai or some other?
Well, that's a good question. Let's go back to our map here. We've got the wilderness of Sin. Let me blank that off. The wilderness of Sin on the maps that are consistent with our lesson book located here. Okay? That's the wilderness of Sin. Now, if we go back to this map, the wilderness of Sin is here, because you have Sinai here. So as I mentioned when I was looking at this, if you take the position that the crossing was here, everything shifts to the east.
Yeah, but is Sin Sinai?
No. Here's the wilderness of Sin, and here's the wilderness of Sinai on this map. Okay?
Must be an Arabic term, so it's not Sin as in doing.
No. No. No, that's correct. You remember in previous studies we talked about the land of Midian? Our map in our book shows it here. And here, in the other map that we were looking at, where everything shifts, there is no land of Midian here, it is here. So, a lot is dependent upon locating these encampments, but how do you do that? You look at the evidence and say, well, I think it's plausible that it be here, and that makes sense. But I can't be dogmatic and say, this is the map, this is where it is.
I can't do that because of the reasons that we have already given. Okay? But here's Elam, and let's pass on down in our lesson book. We'll see that Moses wants them to understand that this is what God had planned all along, to bring them into the promised land. But their complaining is not good. We're going to see that it frequently gets them into a great deal of trouble. Let's bring that on down to our next chart.
The previous slide says one more.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Your first bullet point said a month has passed.
Uh-huh.
How are we getting a month? Because 16 verse 1 says it's...
16 verse 1 says that we're into the second month. So a month has passed. We're already into the second month. What is it? The 15th day of the second month. So a month has already passed.
But when did it tell us that we were at the... trying to figure out where a month came from? I mean, at what point did we start counting that? Because I mean, it says 2.5 months.
Yeah. I think this question is, what is the starting
point? Oh, well, my understanding of the starting point would be the Passover, that from this day forward would begin the
2.5 months
time count.
From Passover.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding.
Oh.
It's 15 days into the second month.
I read that. Okay, I read that wrong.
It's like February 15th.
Yeah, it's like February the 15th. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to say it. Does that help?
Okay. If there were so many people that were being led, God spoke to Moses. Moses spoke to the people. How did all the people hear at once? There must have been people down along the way that were getting information at the same time because they missed communication.
Well, that's another good question. You know, acoustics make a wonderful thing sometimes. And I'm not sure where these announcements were made. But no doubt they were made in such a way that could be understood by the multitudes. I don't know an answer to that. There had to be some means of communicating that to the multitudes. And the locations might play into that, or certainly would play into that.
I was going to say that it appears that later on, sir, they get into Leviticus and places like that, it looks like that even though it says that Moses was talking to the people, a lot of times it was a gathered assembly of the elders and representatives of the families. And
yeah.
They would go back and communicate that to the people that they were sort of the leaders of.
Yeah, that wasn't until later, however.
Yeah, right.
There were 70 elders that were selected, and Moses was to communicate to them, and then they would communicate it down the pike. That's right. But in the initial discussion here of the early Exodus period, I don't know how that was communicated.
But didn't it say earlier on that when Moses and Aaron went to talk to Pharaoh, they took a group of elders with them?
That would be back in chapter 6, is it? 5 or 6?
Very first started talking. I thought I read that.
It would be likely chapter 5.
So I wish I had written that down.
Well, see, I hadn't thought of that.
429.
Before chapter 29?
Oh,
chapter 4, verse 20. I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel, and Aaron spake all the words which Jehovah had spoken unto Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when they heard that Jehovah had visited the children of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshipped. And afterward, Moses and Aaron. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't say that it doesn't say. I just made that connection.
Yeah.
But in chapter 12, verse 21, that's how the instructions about Passover were relayed. The instructions about
cast all through the elders.
A call for the elders of Israel. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Okay. So there had to be some means of disseminating the information where it could be understood by all. But Moses wants them to understand that this was what God had planned. These are the provisions of God. And he will continue to take care of you, which the people evidently just simply don't believe. And that's why when we come into the Hebrew letter in the third and fourth chapters, that they are rebuked because, or the writer tells us they were rebuked and their bodies perished because of unbelief. They didn't believe what God said. Or any other question or comment? As you look in the 14th or the 16th chapter, drop down, if you would, please, to verse 35 in that chapter. We see that God is providing for them. It says, "And the children of Israel did eat the manna 40 years until they came to the land inhabited. They did eat the manna until they came unto the borders of the land of Canaan." Now, an omer is the tenth part of an ephah. Now, I'm going to assume that you well know the means by which they were to be provided for, the gathering of the manna, an omer per person in your family. You would go out in the morning and pick up that measure, whatever it was, and you had nothing over and you didn't have anything short. And Moses told them, don't leave anything until the morning in verse 19 of this chapter. But I want to call your attention to verse 20, which seems to be a pattern for these people. It says, "Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left it until the morning, and it bred worms and became foul, and Moses was wroth with them." So they won't listen again and again. They will not listen and then complain. But they were fed with manna for 40 years when Joshua brought them into the promised land. In Joshua chapter 5, verses 10 and 11, we read that of the end of the provision of the manna. Now they're in a land that flows with milk and honey, and all the things that they need are provided for them. Now, again, I want to call your attention to this next chapter where they encamped in Rephidim. And once again, in verse 1, there was no water to drink. How do the people respond? They murmur. They're complaining again with the things that God has provided for them. And what does God instruct Moses to do to provide water for them so that they can drink? All right, he was to smite the rock, verse 6. "Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel." And we know that the place was called Massa and Meribah because of the striving of the children of Israel, and because they tempted Jehovah, saying, "Is Jehovah among us or not?" How do you like that? Is he among us or not? What had they seen? Every day when you go out to pick up the manna, reckon how it got there. God provided it for them. He had already provided water for them. He had provided for them to cross the Red Sea on dry ground and the plagues in Egypt. They've seen all of these things. And now they raise the question, is he with us or not? In the next few verses, we find that the Amalekites come out to fight against the Israelites. And who wins and how? Tell me about that, John. Yep.
So people had to pop his arms up.
All right. So they got him a rock to sit on, and Aaron and Hur held his hands up so that they could fight and be successful against Amalek. Remember that. They were fighting and they were being successful against the Amalekites. And as we come to the the 19th chapter, the text tells us in verse 1, again, put this on your timeline, in the third month after the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai, where they were departed from Rephidim and were come to the wilderness of Sinai. And they encamped in the wilderness, and there Israel encamped before the mount. And Moses went up unto God, and Jehovah called unto him out of the mountain, saying, Thus shalt thou say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Let's pause right there. 3 months out from the land of Egypt, and they're encamped near Mount Sinai. And God tells Moses, I want you to tell these people, you've seen what I did. Why do you think they need to be reminded of that? The plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea, the provision of the manna, the water, and so forth. I've done all this for you. Now look at verse 5. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be mine own possession from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. Yes.
Now, you say that's, what are we looking at, 90 days? I'm just trying to get these days down and put a place.
About so.
Okay, so the first 45 days that we talked about a couple chapters ago wasn't 45 days after the Passover. It was actually after the Egypt.
Okay.
There's another 45 days that would be after the Passover.
Okay.
I think you were saying after the Passover.
I did. I might have been mistaken about that. I was thinking that the days were counted from the Passover. Let me go back and look at something on that just to help me.
You said that here's where you're going to start counting.
Yeah, chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And Jehovah spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speaking to the congregation of Israel, saying, In the tenth day of this month shall a man take unto them, every man a lamb, etc., etc., as he begins the discussion of the Passover. So this does begin. Now, the thing that I think we're trying to reconcile is the wording, since they left Egypt. Well, how long after the Passover did they leave Egypt? In the observance of the Passover, they were to even be dressed, prepared, staff in hand, shoes on their feet. So their leaving or departure was at hand. Beyond that, the number of the days, if they're not numbered here in the text, I don't know how to do that. All I know is that we're 3 months out, and they made it to Mount Sinai, or this area. Chris and then Richard. We'll get the mathematicians in the family going on those numbers.
Well, we know in chapter 12, he tells Moses to start counting now.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody go out and get their lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And then verse 6. And you keep it until the 14th day.
All right. Okay.
And then that night, they kill an eagle.
Okay. So we're 14 days down in the first month.
And they're still in Israel.
Okay.
They're still in Egypt. They're 14 days in now, counting, and they're still in Egypt.
Okay.
So, I mean, we're shortening our time period even more.
Yeah.
If, you know, a month and a half, they're already through the Red Sea and in the wilderness, but they spent half a month, and they spent 14 days still.
even though we are, if we said 6 months out, just to give ourselves plenty of room, God ought not have to remind them of the great things they've seen. Richard?
No, I was going to say, I guess Chris sort of summed it up. I mean, they left January 15th, as it were.
Okay.
And then when we look at the beginning of this chapter that we're just looking at, which was the 19th.
Yes.
It says, in the third month. So they're just in March sometime.
Yeah.
They're not 90 days away.
Okay.
They're sometime.
Sometime out there.
And it's sometime in the beginning of what we would consider to be March. It could be the first day.
I would say March 15th because it says, and the day that they left Egypt.
Oh, yeah.
Same day.
Okay.
It's the same day they came.
Same day. Okay. Now that all works for me. I have no objection to that. And my reason is this. What God is telling them is emphatic. Don't forget what I've done for you. Now, if you will keep my commandments, keep my ordinances, my statutes, then he said, ye shall be unto me a kingdom and a priest and a holy nation. Now, hold that thought, because that's the biggie I want us to emphasize tonight. When God spoke back over here to Abraham four generations before, how many of him were there? One, he and Sarah. All right, no children. Then finally, years later, he has a son. How many years later? The promise was made in Genesis 12. How old was Abraham?
75.
When Isaac is born, how old is Abraham? 25 years have passed. Didn't change what God said. Now here we're looking at 3 months. Will you keep my statutes? Will you keep my ordinances? If you'll do that, you'll be my people. All the earth is mine, and you belong to me. You'll be a holy nation. What has God confirmed them now to be from the time that he made the promise to Abraham? A people, a nation of people. You can just put a check mark beside that. God fulfilled this promise that he made to Abraham when he brought them up out of the land of Egypt. Now they're at the foot of Mount Sinai, and God himself calls them a holy nation.
I think last week was about that you asked the question, why would they not simply go directly from where they were in Egypt to the promised land? I think also the point has to be is that they needed this time and these situations. They needed these tests. They needed the law to become his people.
Yeah.
You don't have all the issues.
That's true. They needed to learn to depend on him, too. So far, they've had a little trouble with that. All right, David, and then back to Lynn.
Along with what Chris was saying, just one little side point. I seem to notice all the way from Exodus through Deuteronomy. I never heard the word thank you once.
No, I don't suppose you did.
Yeah. You know, I you read about people who are thankful in other parts of the Bible. And, you know, even Solomon prayed and said, how do I lead this people? So pray to people and ask for wisdom. But all the way from Exodus to Deuteronomy, that's like a foreign word.
Uh-huh. Would seem so. Like I say, they're having a hard time learning that they're dependent on God for everything. And I would be interested in seeing it if some of you want to draft it out, this timeline with day-by-day activities. I know I've seen one from someone else that I'm not sure that I can be as affirmative in debating as this gentleman is, but be that as it may, he thinks that it's that definitive. But that's beyond the scope, really, of our study. What I want us to see is that during the process of all of these travels, we're not talking about an enormous period of time, and they forget what God has done for them. And God himself, at this point, identifies these as his people. You belong to me. You are a holy nation. And that's what he promised unto Abraham 400 years prior. Okay? Question? Look at your will while you have your Bible open to the 19th chapter here. I want to read just two or three more verses in this sequence. He says in verse 7, "And Moses came and called for the elders of the people and set before them all these words which Jehovah commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that Jehovah hath spoken we will do." What's your response to that? Leanne chuckles. And it is.
It's not very much longer before they mess up again.
They do the same thing. In fact, if you just turn the pages, now I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to chapter 24. We'll come back and fill in some blanks. But in chapter 24, look if you would at verse 3. We'll pick up the reading at verse 1. It says, "And he came to Moses," or said rather to Moses, "Come up unto Jehovah, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off. And Moses alone shall come near unto Jehovah, but they shall not come near, neither shall the people go up with him. And Moses came and told the people all the words of Jehovah and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Jehovah has spoken will we do." And then if you'll drop down to verse 7, it says, "He took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, all that Jehovah has spoken we will do and be obedient. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it upon the people, and behold, the blood of the covenant which Jehovah had made with you concerning all these words." We'll do it. We'll do it. They say that repeatedly, do they not? We're making a commitment. We're going to do what God wants us to do. And it's absolutely no time at all until they are fussing and complaining about what God has done for them versus what they want God to do. We do the same thing.
Yeah, and Chris just made the comment, and we get the same thing. Often, this evening we've asked the question, how could they behave like this after seeing these miracles? It makes me think a lot of Romans 2 and 14.
All right.
Some insight into this that they, the Israelites learned their behavior from their parents. And their parents learned their behavior in turn from their parents. And we see this going all the way back to the strife in Jacob's family, the sons of Jacob. Mm-hmm. And so it does, throughout the generations, and we're talking some 400 years here, this behavior becomes, as Paul describes in the second chapter of Romans, by nature.
Okay.
And that's, I think that gives us some insight into how these Israelites could see a miracle, like the parting of the Red Sea, and then as one could mess up so quickly.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I don't think this was written so we can look at it and say, well, look at that, look at David. They totally missed the point of all. This really reminds me of what Samuel did to David when he said, there's this guy. And he had someone come and visit him and he slaughtered his lamb for him.
Yeah.
He took this guy's lamb, he only had one. And I said, well, the ones he had. And it was to tell David the story of someone else so that he would understand the benefits. He's doing the same thing with us here. He's telling us the story of what they did. It just never really comes out directly and says, "Not us here."
But he does use that in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He offers many of these illustrations. And Paul said these things happen to them by way of example. They're written for your admonition upon whom the end of the ages are come. So yes, we can look at these and come away, hopefully, with a very valuable lesson. Exactly. Now, another point that I want to make with you before we run completely out of time, how much time do I have?
3 minutes.
About three. Well, I'll do the best I can. In this 19th chapter, we note that the people agree we're going to do what God has instructed us to do. But then when we come to chapter 20, Moses upon the mountain and the giving of the Ten Commandments. But I want to call your attention to verse 2. I'm not specifically interested tonight in discussing in detail the Ten Commandments. I want to note to whom they were given. In verse 2, it says, I am Jehovah thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And then he says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Verse 4, thou shalt not make unto thee a graven image, nor any likeness of anything, etc. Verse 7, thou shalt not take the name of Jehovah thy God in vain. You recognize where we are in the giving of the commandments. But to whom were they given? The Ten Commandments were not given to everybody. The Ten Commandments were given to this nation of people. This was a law, not just ten individualized commandments, but this was a law that was given to these people who were brought up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. In fact, if you'll notice the parallel of this in Deuteronomy chapter 5, Deuteronomy chapter 5, we often refer to the book of Deuteronomy as a restatement of the law. And in chapter 5, in verse 2, it says, Jehovah our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Jehovah made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day. And then in verse 6, I am Jehovah thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Verse 7, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee a graven image. Verse 11, thou shalt not take the name of Jehovah thy God in vain. So we see in both of these accounts, very specifically worded, this is given to this nation, now identified as a holy nation that belongs to God. So to whom were the Ten Commandments given? They were given to the nation of Israel. This was not a law that had already been established. It was not a law that was universal in nature. It was a law that was given to these people. Now, the importance of that is some believe that all you have to do is keep the Ten Commandments because that's what God wants everybody to do. These Ten Commandments were not given to everybody. We'll talk more about that in our next study. All right?